All right, here we go. 3, 2, 1. When NBC announced a few years ago that it would create an American version of the hit British TV show The Office, it sounded to some like the typically desperate move of a studio executive out of ideas. But fast forward to today, and The Office is one of the best and most popular shows on TV with no sign of slowing down. BJ Novak plays Ryan Howard, or BJ Novak plays Ryan Howard, the intern-turned-executive who's trying to drag Dunder Mifflin Paper Company into the new millennium by launching a new website, Dunder Mifflin Infinity. He is here to explain his plans with that website. Actually, no. He's here to explain his role on the TV show. He's also a writer and producer on The Office. And The Office's season finale, by the way, airs this Thursday night on NBC. Thanks for coming in, BJ.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, in that intro, I referred or alluded to the fact that maybe someone could say, oh my God, they're taking another British sitcom and trying to Americanize it, and that sitcom Coupling failed. In the 70s, that idea worked well. Sanford and Son was British and All in the Family was British. But did you have any thoughts about that or any trepidation when you heard that they were going to try to Americanize The Office?
Sure. When it started, there was a lot of skepticism. Including for me, I felt that all things being equal, there was a bigger risk in not even aspiring to do something great. The great thing about the fact of trying to remake The Office, at least you knew what you were aiming for.
Right.
And a lot of shows in the air were just bad, and they were imitating other shows that were bad and imitating other shows that were bad, et cetera. At least we were imitating something that was, or trying to live up to something that was fresh and that we actually admired, as opposed to that we just thought would work on the air.
I mean, I think it was one of those things where it was trendy to say, oh, this is the funniest show on TV when it was airing on the BBC and it was kind of hard to get networks. But I actually thought that. I thought the British Office at the time was as funny as anything that was going out on
TV.
Oh,
yeah. No, it's amazing. It's like a different genre altogether. I don't even think of it as television. It's just like a work.
Yeah, and I think maybe what helped was that they had a limited story arc. That's not the American model. They never say, if there's success, let's limit it to 13 episodes.
Right, and someone told me last night, a British person told me that she felt that there is this, and I've heard this from other people too, but that there is a likability that you need to have for long-term success in America, sort of a knowledge that the person's heart is in the right place, that American audiences aren't comfortable without that, that I think you have in Steve Carell naturally. He doesn't try to do it. He just is so naturally warm deep down that he can't hide
it. I think you may have put your finger on something, because I always thought that it was just translating it. The British can have really dry senses of humor. And I just always found that the British Office, that one big difference was in the American Office, the characters were able to have more victories. And the scene that I think about is, remember in the British Office when Michael Brent did those, oh no, David Brent.
See, you're conflating them already.
When he did those funny dances.
Yeah.
And everyone in the office just kind of shunned him. That same scene in the American Office, at least Steve Carell would get slapped
right
on the
well,
back.
We, the audience, have some knowledge that he is a good, sweet person deep down. And so do the characters.
But that's not a weakness of the American psyche. It's just like if you want to run this show
for a number of years. It's a difference. It's a difference in the talented American actor that you would cast versus the talented British actor. I think different people have different tastes, and I certainly understand a Brit thinking that it is watered down or sold out compared to the way that they like to do it. And but you know, I know plenty of I've met plenty of I have lots of British friends. I've some of my best friends. No, I've met plenty of British people who greatly admire our show, something different. And I certainly, I'm not British, but my God, I love that series.
When early on, and you were involved in it from the get-go, right?
Right. I mean, I didn't create it or adapt it. That's Greg Daniels is the executive producer and showrunner who developed it. But I was one of his staff from the beginning.
And
so I did see the whole process.
Did they hire you as a writer and then they said, let's put him on TV?
Greg had always envisioned having writer actors. He came from Saturday Night Live and the British show, too. I mean, Ricky Gervais was writer actor. So I think he thought that there was something organic and fun and the sort of like playful rebellious spirit and just doing it yourselves like Monty Python or something. So he told me he had always envisioned potentially hiring writer actors. He actually saw me as a performer and thought, oh, maybe he could play the temp.
But doing stand-up, not acting.
Correct. But I think he saw me as a performer and then thought, well, maybe his writing is good too. Let me look at the samples. And I certainly pushed my writing. I had been trying to find work as a writer for a long time and had specs built up and stuff, spec scripts.
Did the idea almost go a lot further than he thought it would in that many more people who are writers or I heard that one of the cast members was a casting assistant, actually.
Yeah, Phyllis was a casting assistant.
It's so funny.
Right, but especially like Phyllis and Paul Eberstein, who plays Toby, who had never acted before, are gifted. I mean, they're not just naturals, or they're not just funny, or they don't just have the right look. I mean, the things they do are enviable on a level of skill that I think even, you know, Steve Carell and Rainn Wilson marvel at them sometimes.
So. To the point where that scene that you're playing out with Mindy as your ex-girlfriend, mm-hmm. which is so painful, and to get you back, she says she's pregnant. The whole scene actually plays out on Toby's face. That's what the camera is on. That's how good he
Maybe
is.
Maybe Mindy and I just messed up that scene really bad. No, Toby is my favorite, I think. Yes, absolutely gifted. And I could watch Toby forever.
Another thing, in the early part of the show,
I went to Costa Rica with Paul as our hiatus last year, and almost killed him with a surfboard. We were learning to surf, and I had a surfboard headed right towards Paul, and the first thought in my head was, no, Toby! Like, my split-second gun-to-my-head instinct was, I am the person that took Toby off the office. I'm going to kill my friend Paul.
Right.
Is... there's no more Toby, and it's my fault because I thought I could surf and I can't.
Paul sneered at you. If I die, Toby dies too. And it's like, I got to kill right. Dark Phoenix, but Jean Grey lurks within.
And of course, the surfboard.
That crazy comic book
The
reference.
Surfboard that I thought was going at a deadly velocity was probably like 2 miles an hour. Paul probably just slowly bobbed his head under the water and was fine. But for me, I'm like, I'm surfing so fast.
But did he give you one of those sad sack looks? Like, oh, I can't believe I'm living through this.
He has a very easy smile that I think came out too. But now there's this storyline where Toby announces that he's leaving to Costa Rica, to move to Costa Rica.
Yeah.
And he had always talked about going to Costa Rica someday, and we wrote that in the script. And the finale is about the goodbye party for Toby as he heads to Costa Rica.
I don't know if I don't know what the process was. Maybe the first few episodes, a fan of the old one, all they do is compare the characters. So, you know, it's, well, Gareth was great, and this new guy, this Rainn Wilson guy, he's no Gareth, but he winds up being, you know, hysterically funny himself. But so
right,
maybe
iconic.
It was...
John McCain just said that he announced Dwight Schrute as his running mate. Did you see that on the
no.
show?
Oh.
So, you know, another sign of just like it's a cultural symbol now. Right. And when the British office was the only thing in people's minds, who would have thought that Dwight Schrute could be like an American iconic creation?
So here's my question to you. Since you were there in the beginning, and I'm telling you right now, I love
trying to use my big words on NPR, by the way.
Yeah, that's what we're here for.
Who would have imagined an American iconic creation? Yes, what?
No, I'm sure the E! Network is down with that. They could edit around that. Don't worry.
Yeah, they could edit out is what they'll do.
Iconic. The producer looks it up and says, I think it has something to do with religion. Off the religion.
Right, you guys are like,
you'll offend the faithful.
You guys are like, oh, these words aren't that big, Novak. I think you're fine. Are these big words for you?
I'm talking to Dan. I'm like, what did he mean by big words? Oh, yeah, iconic. That's right.
Oh, you mean the three-syllable word he used?
So here's my question. I love it now, and I'm saying that because I want to go back. I thought the first few episodes of The American Office, was it just that I was comparing it to the other one? Or do you think that the show has actually gotten a lot funnier? And one of the things I want to point to is I think in the first few episodes, the fact that it was done in the mockumentary style, like that itself was the joke. You weren't really making jokes or, you know, terrific zingers when they would cut to you guys for the close-ups. Were you trying to bring the audience along? Am I just wrong? Was I comparing it to the British office?
You're a little wrong, in my opinion, okay. In that we worked very hard on our jokes. I think we had a lot of good jokes in the first season. But you are definitely right in that we also thought at that point that we could live and breathe as a show partly by simply showing without commenting on what it's like to work in an office.
That's what I meant to say.
Yes. And we would show, I don't know if we actually used it, but, you know, we would show little slices of office life almost as interstitials. And when you cut from one scene to another, you might just show the, you know, a computer keyboard screensaver or something. Or you'd make that sound effect. Thank you. We actually add those a lot still. I don't even know if we ended up putting those in the version, but it's definitely how we envisioned it as we shot the first season. And I think in the second season, it was faster paced. It was more of an emphasis on, okay, we get it. We know what it's like to work in an office. We agree with you. We have it down. What are these characters doing and saying that is specific and interesting and unique and all that? So, yeah, the beginning was a little more general comment, and later it became more about the specifics of Dunder Mifflin.
Was there a change, or from the get-go was the idea that we could really spend, you know, 5 minutes, which on a network sitcom is a real long time, and do one or two jokes, but really just emphasize the drama, the romance, the human angle. Mm-hmm. You know, we could get by on that. We could live on that and not have to do a gag every 30 seconds like, you know, a sitcom Like, is the rule on a sitcom? Did you know you could, you'd be able to go for that and achieve it from the get-go?
I think when we started, actually, single camera, as they call it, which are... It's actually not a single camera. We have a couple cameras going
on. Because if that
one
breaks...
Right. Yeah, yeah. We have a backup camera.
Okay.
But compared to, you know, Seinfeld,
right.
To use a great example, or Cheers, you know, our shows that have four camera setups and a studio audience, and they have a theatrical feel. And when we started, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, it was really the infancy of the single camera show. Scrubs had been a moderate hit, but it was still considered very alternative and quirky. And My Name is Earl was a big experiment in single camera shows.
Right.
Now it seems to be the norm for new comedies. But at the time, yeah, at the time that was new and different. And part of the problem with it in executives' minds was you can't force a laugh every 30 seconds, you know? How are you going to guarantee that? If you don't hear a studio audience laughing, maybe they're just going to coast by on making the audience smile without actually making them laugh. Now, I think we, again, I think we have very hard-hitting jokes from the beginning in healthcare and the Alliance and Diversity Day and Hot Girl.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
All those episodes have, I think, a lot of lines we really sweated over. We want them laughing every 15, 20 seconds, but we're not going to force it if it's an emotional scene. And it's great that we can have a show. I think our show wouldn't work as a multi-camera show for a number of reasons, but one of which is that we don't want to force the pace, and we're really trying to make it feel real and transport people to experiences they've actually had. And sometimes you'll laugh 5 times in 10 seconds, and then you'll just watch a scene unfold for a minute.
And that's okay.
That's ideal for us.
Yeah.
It's close to real life.
I want to ask you, so a lot of producer writers on the show, and sometimes you write specific episodes. So are there rules? Because I can imagine if you just let it get out of control, there are too many cooks to spoil the broth.
It's not out of control. It's very, very well controlled. Greg Daniels, again, is the executive producer in television. The very official sounding term is showrunner. And that says it all, the person who runs the show. And it's his show the way that a writer-director would be in charge of a movie. You know, he hires the writing staff and he'll delegate scripts for each person to write. But when you take a turn writing a script, Greg has very carefully approved or come up with or combined different ideas into the story that you're going to write. And he knows what all the scenes are going to be. He doesn't know what all the jokes are going to be, although he knows some of them. But he sends you out with a very specific packet of notes and you come back and then he'll look at that with the other writers, and they'll edit it and edit it with you and maybe ask you to rewrite a scene or two. So it is very collaborative, but at the same time, it's very focused with a very clear leader.
So to speak specifically, a recent episode that you wrote that recently aired was Office, the chair model.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the name of the chair model?
Mm-hmm.
He Michael falls in love, or at least is inspired by the beauty of this woman sitting in an office chair in a catalog, and he wants to start dating again.
Mm-hmm.
So you going in as the writer, did he tell you, here's what we need. We need Michael to start dating again, and we need the topic of the engagement to come up. And go with that
where
you will.
The engagement came up out of a very late group rewrite.
Huh?
Well after I handed in a draft of the script that was pretty different from what we ended up shooting in a lot of ways. So, you know, in that we came up with what are Jim and Pam doing? I forget what I had them. Originally I had, I think, a management training that Jim was putting Dwight through, management training that was phony. And it had some good jokes, but the network, I think, smartly pointed out it felt like we had done it before even though we hadn't. You
right.
Know? So we tried to think as a group what would be better, and we thought, oh, maybe Jim and Pam move in together. And then we thought, why wouldn't they just get engaged? And we thought, because we haven't decided that yet. And we just decided, let's jump a step ahead of the audience, so we put that in there.
Real-life engagements have happened for stupider reasons.
But, well, we thought, why are we holding it back? He would propose, wouldn't he? We were trying to think, why wouldn't he, and what would he do instead? But the answer is he would, or he would be close to it. So we wrote that in as a group. That wasn't me. I was thrilled to have it in a script with my name on it because everyone thought I had such a great, you know, touch with the romance and the comedy and all that. But, you know, that was a group effort right there. I wrote some of the date scene, I remember, came out a lot like I had envisioned it with the date with the landlady. But, you know, a lot of that was casting, too.
Yeah.
So it is very collaborative.
Did you write that gag where he's in the equivalent of Starbucks and says, no, I'm not Michael. And then the guy calls out his coffee name. Michael!
Yes.
Michael! He's the only
yes.
one there.
And again, that was a very group-written episode, but I did happen to write that.
Good stuff.
And I liked, is who Michael what? Was the line in response to, are you Michael Scott?
Is who Michael what?
And again, a lot of times, you know, there's such a writer impulse to sort of cringe and brace yourself when you hand your script off to be filmed and produced. And this is one of the only experiences I've ever been exposed to where the writers can't wait for it to get in the hands of the actors. Like a line like that, Steve Carell is going to make it more brilliant than you ever thought. And that's so rare because writers are so egotistical about what they've written. And to actually honestly expect in your heart of hearts that they're going to make it better than you imagined, like there's very few places where that will happen.
But this is a scripted and show. This is not like Curb Your Enthusiasm. I mean,
correct.
Really, everything is scripted, and you allow for some maybe bits of
absolutely.
Actorial
there's
improv.
Some there's some improvisations, yeah. Especially Steve leads the way, Rain, and everyone does to some extent, especially in the later takes. I find that just the fact that we know we're going to improvise at the end helps us keep it real, both in the writing and the acting in the previous takes, because if it felt very different when you started improvising, all of a sudden it felt natural and real, you'd know something was off with the script, you know?
Back to the one question about Chair Model, that last scene where they're singing American Pie and
yes.
kind of not getting the words.
Uh-huh.
Did you write that?
I'll tell you the whole process of that.
Yeah.
The answer is no, but I contributed.
Okay.
And again, everything, and the writers could go over it forever. Some episodes you write almost the whole thing, some you write almost none. Some you contributed the line that the only line anyone remembers, whatever. In that particular example, just to show you how complicated the process is, Jen Salata and Paul Lieberstein had added, I had a very minimal story about the chair model herself, and they kind of pushed the story, restructuring, focusing on the chair model as this interesting dark thread throughout, and it was their idea to lead it up to the graveyard.
Because we should say that he finds out that the chair model has passed away.
Yes.
Yes.
Dwight finds out.
Yes.
And
he sleuths it.
And so the staff then wrote a parody song of Candle in the Wind. Goodbye, Deborah Shoshlevsky. I never knew you at all. I saw you in a catalog, and you made that chair look good. And it went on from there. Elton John would not give us the permission for that song. Apparently, we had heard 30 Rock. They're throwing up their arms in the studio here. 30 Rock apparently had requested permission for a song parody of Candle in the Wind that offended Elton John deeply. I can only imagine what they came up
because
with.
Because we know of Elton John and his strict standards of taste.
Well, I'm telling you. I mean, obviously,
this is...
This
is a man who will dress like Donald Duck, but not Daffy.
But there is there is an integrity to him, and I can only imagine what the dark, wonderful writers at 30 Rock had come up with to parody this beautiful song about, you know, Marilyn Monroe and Princess Diana and all that. So he wouldn't even consider licensing the song to us. He didn't even want to know what our concept was. Apparently he was so offended. So we wrote other parodies. We wrote She's Got Legs. We wrote Goodbye Ruby Tuesday to Goodbye Deborah Shostovsky. And I'm fudging her name because I can't quite remember how we pronounce it in the episode. And eventually American Pie cleared. We had heard it never clears, but it cleared. And the last take, we were going to have them sing She's Got Legs, She Knew How to Use Them, which we had cleared. And then it was my idea on the set. I was like, so this is the one place I contributed the whole process of the song. I said, how about when you cut back to them at night, they're still singing American Pie. They forgot all about the chair model aspect. They're singing their hearts out. It's just Michael and Dwight in a graveyard singing American Pie at the top of their lungs, dancing around. They forgot all about the death and the darkness.
And they don't really get the words.
They get the words as much as you and I would if we had one take to get the words. They kind of sort of got the words. And it was so wonderful. And once we saw that one take, Jeff Blitz, the director, and I were like, there's no other way to end the show if you have that on tape, you know. It was wonderful. So, again, I had a very small contribution there, but it was an honor to be a part of it in that way.
I didn't ask you about the character you play, Ryan Howard. In the original British Office, this guy, he almost didn't have a line. He was just the guy who showed the office, and they never went to him again. So they introduce your character in episode one, but you grow. You stay with the show as a temp. Mm-hmm. And now you're in management. Are you happy with the turn your character has taken?
It's very, very exciting and fun to play something so different from where it started. That's very cool. And I think the fun of the character is that he's in so far over his head, and he wears it so poorly. And I cringe watching it a little bit. It's very fun to be in that character, and it's fun to be like, oh, no, that guy, you know, because for so long I was watching that guy and go off and do his thing. But I think the key for me that made it actually satisfying to play was realizing, okay, when am I the biggest jerk I am? When does my dark side come out? And it's always when I'm not confident at all. You know, I think the first instinct I would have had would be to play that character with just so much confidence.
Right.
But deep down, whenever I'm confident, I am my warmest, truest self, you know, or best self. Maybe not truest, but my warmest self, because I'm comfortable with myself. I like you. You're a great radio host. Everything is going well. I'm grateful to be here. When you're not confident, you're like, oh, he doesn't even want to say hi to me. Who am I? You know, yeah. And you walk past people with a scowl, or you know, overcompensate.
Right. Or you fall back on that crazy internet-y jargon business speak.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
What Ryan Howard would.
Right.
He says,
truly,
this is safe.
Truly confident people or real big bosses of companies I've always noticed, they always speak in the most direct, casual, straightforward language. And it's always their second and third in command that use all the jargon and go in circles.
Yeah.
And so Ryan, I mean, people were surprised when he got the job because he wasn't qualified. Absolutely true. And that's why I think he comes off so badly, is because he's got to know deep down that he shouldn't have this job.
One question I always wondered about.
But ideally, it's funny.
Oh, yeah.
You know, all the justification in the world doesn't justify, like, it should make you laugh. It should make the story move ahead. So.
But if you play a scene just because I think this will be the funniest way to emphasize it, it's not as funny as if you have the internal logic motivating
it. I'll take a step back. You got to start with what's true and then keep what's funny.
One thing I always wondered about is, have you guys in the cast, the crew, everyone, worked out the exact definition of what this documentary is, that The Office is, that someone's shooting this documentary and you keep looking at the camera? Mm-hmm. Is there a definition of who they are, what they're shooting for,
where the
camera stands?
That's a great question. We've never discussed it as actors. As writers, we've discussed it vaguely. Probably everyone has a different concept in their head. If you ask Steve what Michael thinks, if he comes on the show, you should ask him, what does Michael think this documentary is for? Does he think it's going to make him a star? Does he think it's going to air on TV? Does he think it's for a movie? He might have a very different answer than what Pam thinks. Or probably after being there for so long, they figure, like, first of all, they're very comfortable with it. And second of all, probably the idea that they're going to be a star from it is kind of faded. I mean, they've been there for years. But that's just my interpretation.
Are there many jokes, I'm trying to think, where we either see the
camera... It's probably something like that Michael Apted, you know, 7-Up or something, where they film you for...
Yeah, I was thinking it's like a Frederick Wiseman and he becomes a fly on the wall, although they do the, confessional interview, so that would be a break from that. But yes, they mostly have stopped noticing the camera.
Right.
Except when, every once in a while, because they're hams, they do.
Right. Well, apparently when people film those reality shows, you know, after a couple days, they just, you know...
Yeah.
Live their life.
Then again, they're all preening narcissists and one.
Well,
the
there's
other shows.
Yeah, that's true too.
So the question I was asking was:
I'm trying to think if I have any friends on one of those shows and make an exception for.
You have a
I'm
background.
I'm going to remember after
you have
the show,
a background
I'm
on MTV,
LC or something. Yeah.
Have they ever done a gag where you saw the camera or the camera clunked into a wall or something like that?
We have those on tape.
Uh-huh.
They're distracting, I think, has been the verdict so far. Sometimes a camera will guide a character in a rare situation. It will sort of bob its head up and down and nod Pam in a certain direction. Or in the recent episode Night Out that Mindy Kaling wrote, Steve Carell noticed a woman that he'd been hitting on was talking to another guy, and he turned to see her because the camera turned.
Right.
So he responded
right,
to that.
Right, that's right.
But those are rare, and they tend to be distracting. So while they make sense in the logic of the show, I think often they simply don't feel right.
Right. In a mockumentary movie, you could talk about the camera a lot more. You have an hour and a half. And, like, Spinal Tap made more jokes that were cognizant of the fact that this guy was making a documentary.
Yeah, it works as a documentary. Yeah, but I think most casual viewers don't really see it as that. They just see it as, you know, a low-key show where people talk to the
right.
camera sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. People, if you quiz them, they might say, oh, yeah, that's right. There is a documentary aspect to it. I don't even – after maybe
yeah,
that's a sign
I think
of success.
We think about,
see
we think about
yeah.
the documentary. It definitely keeps us honest and it keeps us real and it keeps a logic to the way we film. But I think that we think about it way more than most viewers do. They just watch a TV show.
The Office is innovative not only in the fact that you have so many actor writers and that you say, hey, let's just cast the person who is funny in the writer's room, but also the way that viewers can get it. It's on iTunes. It's on this Hulu site. You seem to have embraced perhaps a lot more than other shows the fact that people aren't just going to watch on Thursday nights. They could watch it wherever. So mm-hmm. does that affect your life at all? Do either people coming up to you or in any way how you do the show?
I think it makes people much more careful viewers. People often know which episodes I've written, and they know, you know, little details that they could only have caught on a second or third viewing or background information. I was at a dinner last night. This is a crazy anecdote. I was at dinner last night, and John McCain was there. And someone told me John McCain loves The Office. And I had heard that he had, you know, said that Dwight Schrute should be his running mate. And I kind of quiz a little bit. I'm like, Well, what did I say? That was what I was thinking. I was like, oh, I would love to know what his favorite moments are, like, so I can tell the rest of the staff, because I want to know, like, does he really watch or did someone tell him to watch? And when I was introduced to him, he started giggling and he said, I love in the dinner party episode when they go up to Michael's bedroom and you can see that there's a camera set up there. And that went by so fast. Like, either McCain has a sharp eye or he's the kind of thing that kind of guy is like, wait, go back. And he said he watches on a Comcast DVR, you know? So, I mean, that's an exception for the 74-year-old demographic or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But
the former prisoner of war demographic, I hear you're strong in.
Oh, we've always dominated in those specific subcategories. Yeah.
Right. Maverick Republican trend very
military
well.
Military hero, Republican nominee. We tend to do well.
Right.
You know, knock on wood, that continues.
Dole likes you too. So that'll be both, I guess.
18 to 34-year-old males and that, yeah. But, you know, that wasn't. Aside from the fact that who was telling me this, which was insane, that's the kind of thing I hear all the time, is a very specific moment, maybe even in the background, probably was paused, definitely was watched on a DVR or an iPod or was stolen off the internet or a DVD or often deleted scenes are quoted to me.
Do you often find yourself hanging out in places where the Republican nominee is?
Yeah. Well, I have an apartment adjacent to Congress. No. I brought it up because it was crazy. Come on.
It's awesome. I want to ask you about your comedy. How has being on the show affected that?
Made me funnier, man.
Mm-hmm. What do you heard? Seinfeld says you, like, earn a free 45 seconds.
And he then said that about me?
No. He said BJ Novak. He says, you know, being a TV star.
Let's talk about BJ Novak, Jerry Seinfeld. Let's talk about him.
Is that how you began the interview? What's the deal with Novak? Yeah. No, he just says, like, being on a TV show.
He's a writer.
What's the deal? Is that his name? Yeah, he goes out in front of a crowd. He could say anything for 45 seconds. By second 60, if he's not funny, he's just not funny.
Yeah, I walked on the stage once, and the crowd cheered so loud, and obviously they were simply cheering for The Office. And I thought, you know, it's one thing if U2 walks on stage and thousands of people cheer because you got amps in the stage and you blow them right back, you know. But I'm like, oh, man, I don't know if deadpan one-liners, I'm just going to slowly lose their love over the course of the hour. Not that it's all deadpan one-liners, but that's where my fearful brain focused on right away. But I think there's a lot of truth to what he said. I think in a good way, a lot of what I've always done on stage is a little subtle and experimental, and I am freer to be more myself because often I would spend, when I was unknown, spend a long time kind of winning the audience over, warming them up, trying to let them stiff my hand like a dog would and show, I am a likable guy, I'm mainstream, you'll get me, you'll like me. Now here's the kind of crazy thing that I think is funny, you know. And when you've been on The Office for a while, you have a fan base that comes in and is totally willing to let you try something different and subtle, and I'm able to do more what I like to do.
That's a very good answer. Here's my last question. I read on Wikipedia, so it must be true, your dad edited the big anthology of Jewish humor.
The big book of Jewish humor. He's the co-editor of that book, yeah.
What's your favorite example from that book kind of Jewish joke?
I love, first of all, I love the Wise Men of Helm. I always read those stories.
That's very highbrow.
Is it, though? I mean, they're very, the whole
well,
joke
not,
is that
it's
they're
not
stupid.
Rabbi walks into a bar. They're stupid, but they outsmart the
well, that's the
bizarre.
Thing, and that's my favorite thing about Jewish humor has been that it's so much about logic.
Yeah.
And it's so much about a stupid logic that is actually something you never would have thought of and makes sense on
another
level.
I have a total theory about that.
What's that?
Well, if you're an observant Jew, you know, you read the Bible and you read the Torah, and it gives you these rules, and all you do is spend your life trying to argue around them. So it's like, well, I can't light a light, but I could put it on before.
Yeah, yeah, there's a lot of logic.
I could get a Sabbath goy.
And my favorite joke, I don't remember if it's from this book. My dad also co-edited the big book of New American Humor, which wasn't the perennial, you know, bar mitzvah bestseller that this one was. But I loved it. That's where I first read Michael O'Donohue and a lot of, you know, great, dark, you know, writers. P.G. O'Rourke, actually, in the National Lampoon, wrote some really amazing stuff. But my favorite joke, I can't remember if it's from one or the other of those books, but it's definitely from one of them. A man walks into a cake shop, and he says, I'd like you to make me a cake in the shape of a B, the letter B. And he says, okay, great, good, come back tomorrow. So he comes back tomorrow. He opens a box, looks at the cake, says, I am so sorry. I should have been more specific. I meant a lowercase b. I will pay for it. I will have you do it again. I'm so sorry. The guy says, no, I should have asked. I'll redo it for free. Come back tomorrow. Comes back the next day. Guy looks at the cake, says, oh, my mistake. I can't believe I didn't say this. It has to be a lowercase cursive b. The guy at the store says, all right, well, I am going to charge you this time, but come back tomorrow. Guy comes back the next day. Looks at the cake. It's a lowercase cursive b. The guy says, perfect. Oh, perfect. Exactly what I wanted. Thank you so much. Here's your money. Here's a tip. The guy in the cake store says, oh, I'm so relieved. Let me wrap that up for you. And the guy says, no, that's okay. I'll eat it here.
Awesome.
I don't know why that was always just, that joke blew me away. It's like a joke structure that you should see more often. Just such a weird surprise to me. Maybe it's not funny. I always
like that's
it.
A great joke. I don't know if the guy would be Jewish, so I think that might be the American humor one. Like, is that
there's a logic to the joke itself. Yeah. I don't know. I just know I love it.
I guess it becomes Jewish. We go, I'll eat it here.
Yeah, but that's not the it's not the attitude. It's sort. Yeah. It could be anyway. It could be Will Ferrell, doing that. It's just it is kind of an all-American. Like, where is this crazy energy coming from?
By the way, did you use growing up in a?
Hey, you said that was my last question.
So yeah, I know.
Really, honestly, this has been a nightmare of an interview. So. No respect.
I will throw one more in. Which
bonus
is,
question, please.
Yes.
I am, of course,
DVD extra. So growing up with a dad who did this and who knows comedy, but you do more alternative comedy, did you view that kind of, the classic rabbi walks into a bar joke as a foundation, or did you view it as more something to note but rebel against?
Great question. I think it was more something that I just grew up with an inherent love for. And if I mean, comedy is so much about surprise that you can't just rattle off a formula because they'll see it coming. Like that letter B joke that I just told, why I loved it so much. I never saw that coming. It was so different. So I think I love those jokes. My whole family loves just sort of classic jokes. And my favorite comedian growing up was this family friend of ours named Jonathan Katz, who just wonderful, classic, clever one-liners one after another. And that was a real bedrock love of comedy that really delivered, really had a great punchline and wasn't sort of alternative or avant-garde. And I got into Andy Kaufman when I was in high school, but that was, I think, to me it was the same tradition. It was just really delivering to the audience and twisting the expectations further. So to me, I guess, no, it wasn't anything to rebel against. It was something that I loved and I felt the natural continuation was surprising people even more, being even more weird and different.
BJ Novak, co-star, writer, and producer of The Office. The season finale is Thursday. Also, upcoming stand-up comedy performances at the Moore Theater in Seattle on May 30th and Caroline's in New York on June 5th through 8th. Thanks a lot, BJ.
Thank you so much. It was really cool to come in.
Cool.